This was unique in the ferocity, the high temperature. There was melted aluminum, melted glass. There was nothing in some of these. I mean, it was just a pile of ash. And that level of destruction, I mean, they've equated it to, like a nuclear blast. Like this was like Hiroshima, as far as the, how hot these temperatures got and how complete the destruction was. That was new.
Welcome. I am Dr. Sarah Spelsberg. I'm your host on this edition of the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. And today we are going to hear from a Hawaiian physician responding to the front lines of the Lahaina Maui fire disaster. Dr. Sean Rowland is a board-certified family medicine physician and the founder and CEO of Jace Medical. He also has experience in rural and critical access hospitals as an emergency department physician and hospitalist. He has international experience working in hospitals in Mexico, as well as in hospitals from the east to west coast of the United States. Dr. Rowland's search and rescue experience goes back to his EMT days as an undergrad at the University of Utah, where he served for 6 years on the Salt Lake County Sheriff's search and rescue team. He has received training as a mountain rescue associate, technical rock rescue, high angle rescue, dive rescue specialist, avalanche rescue, and swift water rescue. He currently resides on the north shore of Oahu, Hawaii, with his wife and 4 daughters. So, Sean, I cannot thank you enough for joining us to discuss this incredibly tragic disaster response. I really appreciate your time. I know you're quite busy.
Very happy to be here. It's a chance to just spread awareness and educate and empower people so that they too can learn and benefit from something like this tragedy, and try and find what we can to learn and hopefully be better prepared the next time.
Oh, for sure. If we can learn from our experiences, and certainly in disasters like this, and we can be better prepared for the next time, I really like that. So tell me more about your background in emergency and disaster medicine.
So, as you mentioned, going back to my undergrad days, I was fortunate to be of the search and rescue team with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Department, and it's an interesting environment there in Salt Lake City. We covered the county, and there in that particular county, we were responsible for the Great Salt Lake, which was it's kind of an ocean environment. So everywhere from that end of the valley to the other end, you're in high altitude doing some pretty serious rock climbing and expedition kind of medicine up in the Wasatch Range, and everything in between. So it afforded a lot of really good experience for me early on. I was an undergrad. I was able to get my EMT license through that process, and that was kind of my first foray in not just when you think about all the different ways you can encounter patients, but also, how systems are built, how the EMS system works, how chains of command and communication and a lot of these other things. That was a really good initial, course into all those things for me. And then, of course, I through med school and residency, had a drum degree as I focused on just learning the medicine, learning what you need to learn to be a good physician. And then on the other side, being able to go back into that environment, let my, try and put those skills to use again. And that's what brought me to Aerial Recovery Group, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yes, we will. That was one of my next questions, is first tell me more about your day job and your day-to-day work, as well as the organizations and initiatives you've spearheaded to ensure that teams are ready to respond to disasters and that people are ready to handle a disaster. I know you're affiliated with Aerial Recovery Group, but you are also the founder of Jace Medical. So tell me more about those things.
Yeah, so I really am. My passion you know, it's the way I out of residency, I ran kind of a private concierge practice, even throughout residency. My passion really, when I deal with a patient, empowerment is really the name of the game for me. And that takes time. It takes time to educate about what's going on with their illness so that you can make joint decision making. They can feel like that, and I want them to take ownership of their health and be and play a part in this decision making and have the right buy-in and understand why we're doing what we're doing. That all takes time, and unfortunately, at least in the United States, the way our health system is built, it's not really ideal for that kind of an environment. It's a lot more fast-paced. You know, especially in primary care, we need to see a lot of patients. We need to see them quickly. We need to focus on whatever the problem is that's in front of us. I wanted to take things a little more holistically, a little more where I had the time that I could spend that was necessary to spend and talk to a patient about everything that's going on, because it all, you know, health isn't just one problem at a time. And so that led to that private practice. But that empowerment mission really over COVID started to form, and I got a whole genesis story for the company, which we don't have to get into, but at its core, Jace Medical is, our mission is to empower people to be better prepared medically. And we wanted to create a way, through leveraging the technology of telemedicine, that they could come to the website and get access to antibiotics, to chronic medications like blood pressure, thyroid, diabetes, whatever the chronic condition is. We offer an antibiotic pack that we've pre-selected, pre-configured, what would be the most beneficial to have on hand if you were caught without medical care, if you're out in the backcountry, if you're traveling, if there's a supply chain disruption, if there's a massive fire that disrupts your community.
Everything.
This is what would be useful and still accessible from a price standpoint. And then also I mentioned the chronic medications. So it's all done through a telemedicine process. It's quick and easy, and you get these meds delivered to your door. Comes with a guidebook, tells you how to take it. If you can't get a hold of your doctor, who would be the best person to tell you what to take at any given time. But if you really are out, cut off from modern care, you've got some other backup options to help you guide you in the proper use of these medications. But again, it's empowerment, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, too, as we get into kind of the specific things that we encountered. But that is my day job. That's what I'm dedicated to.
Love that.
As a means to support my family. Yeah. And that carried over because of that experience and meeting the right people in the right time, which is another thing we'll get into as far as networking goes. Carried it over into every recovery group.
Oh, and how long have you been working with them?
So this was my first call out with them. I've known their chief medical officer, Aaron Acey, for a number of years now. Let's see, it's been 3 or 4 years now. And this was kind of the first time the stars aligned. And I'm sure it was in no small part because I live less than an hour from where all this happened. By plane, less than an hour where all this happened on Maui. Yeah. And so, you know, I was myself and a Air Force paramedic in the National Guard here were the first two over there to meet up with the team.
Oh, wow. Because, I mean, we talked earlier and you live not far from a private airstrip. And so did you all just jump in a Cessna and load it up with gear and fly over there?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, so part of having this private practice and with Jace Medical, I have, when it comes to, and just my own, you know, past experience with search and rescue and wanting to be, you know, preparedness is a big thing in my world. Mm-hmm. I've got a pretty good supply of medical supplies, of medications, of antibiotics, of chronic meds, and emergency supplies, you know, ATLS stuff. You know, I've got point of care ultrasound, stuff for intubation, just the list goes on. And So I was able to just, I was there. I had it all. Let's package it up. And we threw it on. My neighbor happens to be a Hawaiian Airlines pilot and has his own little plane. And so we just loaded up and off we went. As soon as we knew that we had, you know, we had aero recovery was activated. They had an incoming team. We didn't want to just, I wasn't just going to go fly over there and say, here I am, guys. But we had a mission and we had a way through those, through aero recovery and contacts to the area and not just be, you know, people who were there hoping to help and get in the way, which can happen as well. And all well-intentioned. But in a situation like this with so much going on, the last thing you want to do is be a distraction to the effort. And so once we knew that that was in place, then it was all systems go.
And so your experience has been incredibly diverse. I mean, the terrain alone, I'm well versed in search and rescue. I was in search and rescue in Colorado and I mean, Utah is very extreme terrain. And so responding to those disasters and then responding to, you know, beachside disasters, it's extreme no matter where you are on that spectrum and in altitude. If you don't have what you need and everything's lost, it becomes a dire situation. And I think that's just incredible. And so in what capacity did Aerial Recovery Group respond to the Lahaina fire disaster? Was it focused on running in with medical, or was it focused on like, hey, we can logistically help with supply distribution, or where all did you find, where did you find yourselves the most helpful, I guess?
Yeah, really a little bit of everything. So Aerial Recovery Group, you know, it's a multidisciplinary group of individuals. Yes, there's certainly a heavy component on the medical side of things. You know, they always want to go with at least a medic. Typically, they have a medic and a PA. In this case, we had a medic and myself as a. We also had an EMT. And then they've also got kind of technological assistance with some pretty advanced drone capabilities that can do full 2D and 3D mapping, thermal imaging. Awesome. And so that was another aspect of what we wanted to help with. And then, yes, you mentioned the logistical support, you know, helping manage supply lines and even just bodies to help search, who are aware of, you know, how to stay in a grid pattern. And we had one USAR certified person on the team, should there need to be a need for, you know, going into structures and doing things safely that way. So really, yeah, these guys come with a lot of experience. Most of them, are ex-military and rescue before. I myself am not ex-military, but, certainly with experience with search and rescue and kind of command chain, you know, chain of command stuff that is necessary when you're you've got multiple, you know, fire departments, National Guard, police departments, FEMA, a lot of different entities. That are all trying to communicate on some level with each other.
And it helps. I think the more people our team has, people who've spanned all disciplines, you know, like you're more like me. You started out in medic on SAR and you, when you're doing work like that, you're working with a lot of military people. You know, I've always ended up working with a lot of military people, so I'm comfortable with their language, their, you know, their verbiage. I'm comfortable with that response. And also having trained, you know, with fire EMS, I think just being able to communicate, understanding how the different disciplines expect to be communicated with, that helps so much. I think that's an incredible thing that Aerial Recovery Group does is they train people so well.
Yeah, it's a great, you have to know the parlance. You have to, I mean, that's how you're going to gain credibility. It's part of gaining credibility in their eyes, and it is really important. You're right on.
Yeah. So how close were you to the fires personally? I mean, this all happened so fast. You know, I had friends who were there for a medical conference and flew out that day, and then got home and saw this on the news, and they were just heart. I mean, it is, yeah, the whole world is gutted for the community.
The timeline timeline for us was, you know, the fires Tuesday night, basically everyone woke up Wednesday morning, to this tragedy. And that's when the ball started rolling and the machine started moving over at Aerial Recovery, texting back and forth. And I was ready to go Wednesday afternoon. Didn't want to get there too early without the team. So just kind of sat on my hands, really anxious and anxious to get going. Thursday, we took off for Maui, and you got everyone together. Took a little bit of time. Situation like this, while we did have local contacts, which were very important to help us kind of navigate the immediate area and some of the politics there, and ultimately were vital to gain access. So West Maui, it's only got a couple of ways in and out, and it was locked down. The police department had completely blocked off access to West Maui. And so they were letting people out, but they were not letting anyone in. And
understandably,
and so that was the order of the day was, okay, yeah, we need to get access to the site. And so we were able to get to the chief of police there pretty early on, let him know who we were, what the capabilities were. Basically said, hey, we can get in there right now, start getting mapping going of the areas to assist in the search, and then we've got medical personnel who can help however needed once they're in there. And so that was enough for them to give us that approval. We got in, and by then it was starting to get dark. And so what we did that first night was we went to the surrounding area. We don't, you know, we drove through the Lahaina, which is the town, which is the main town that was affected, where all the burned out buildings were. And we went through there to the surrounding communities that were the ones that were affected at this time. Cause you had, you know, initially the really sick burned patients and those people, now, you know, we're talking, almost 2 days after, they had all made it out to hospitals if they were going to get out. And that immediate acute care need was pretty much met. But what you then had was all the fallout from people who had fled to surrounding areas, and then the residents themselves who were okay in their homes. But at this point, there was no power, there was no cell service, there were no basic services for a pretty wide area along West Maui. And so you had all these affected people, interestingly, who many of them, I guess, could have left the area to get power, water, to get food, to get... but they didn't really have anywhere to go, and they were told that if they left, they couldn't come back to their homes. And so that was an interesting, complicating factor behind all of this. And maybe I'll touch on it again later, but went in, and we had initially already had some people who had reached out and said, hey, there's such and such person here. We had a person who had a pretty badly infected foot, was basically immobile, was in one of these homes in the middle of, this pitch black dirt road neighborhood, outside of Lahaina. And so as we were kind of learning the area, we wanted to go do this medical check on this individual, and on the way there met multiple individuals, people, you know, he had someone with a fractured ankle and some burns, some decent burns to his ears and head, who didn't want to leave again for the same reason, didn't want to leave his family, didn't want to not be able to get back. And so rendered aid kind of as we went, then ultimately found this patient, and we were able to get him, check in on him, get him the right antibiotics, to get him enough, basically, so that he could take the next couple of days to get out to a higher level of care. And that was kind of the order of, that was kind of what we spent the night doing. Our first night there. The next day we did get down into searching through the ash, and spent the better part of that day doing that. And that turned into, you know, that was where my expertise were probably best lent. So I pulled out of there after a little bit and worked really hard for the next 3 days, basically coordinating all the medical supplies, medical tents, all the different people who were trying to come in and help. We had a really amazing kind of grassroots community effort. People were bringing supplies in by boat. They were bringing them in by air. They were, you know, because it was hard to get stuff in because of how they were locked
down. And people are amazing.
And yeah, it was incredible. And so we had mountains of gear. And so these things would spontaneously pop up like a distribution center. And the community would know that's where they go to get their diapers and their food. And there was warm meals, there were vet tents, medical tents. That was all community run, and it was kind of a controlled chaos, but it ran really well as far as there was no fighting, there was no hoarding, and it worked really well. But coordinating that to let people know, okay, there's this here, and we've got this, and because again, and this was a challenge, I would say, was communications. Not having cell phone, not having internet, not having really any means of communicating across more than what would be like a walkie-talkie distance, was really challenging to coordinate everything with, because there were plenty of people that wanted to help and there were plenty of supplies, but it needed to be coordinated. And so that's what I spent the better part of my time doing. There was other parts of our team that were spent the whole time mapping with the drone, high-res 3D, just incredible maps. But as far as from the medical side, that was the bit.
I mean, just what an incredible gift to give people stranded in a disaster like this is to roll in with such targeted technology and targeted supplies and targeted skills. And it's just brilliant. It really is. I almost broke down in tears, right? Just listening to you just there. It's really beautiful what you all did.
Well, tearjerker stories if you want them, but you still feel inadequate and you still feel like, man, this is a dropper zone we're in, and you want to make the biggest impact. Exactly. And the scale of this disaster was probably one of the unique thing for me here versus other things. You know, I've been, whether it's in the backcountry in really austere environments, whether it's, you know, working in the rural ED when you have a rollover in an SUV and a family comes in, sure, all those kinds of things, and they're horrific, but nothing to the scale of 2,200 structures destroyed. 86% of them were residential structures.
Some
counts are still in place, but you know, 1,200 to 1,600 people missing. I want to say it was somewhere around a little over 2,000 acres, in the immediate area. And then of course around there, everything still that's affected. So the scale of it, that was new for me. That was something that, was a little bit hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah. And I've been in fire zones before where we were maybe going to get evacuated, maybe not. And the fires always kind of felt like a hurricane. It gives you time. It says, hey, you know, in 3 days, I may or may not come destroy you. And with the fires, it's like, oh, the winds are picking up, they're shifting directions. But this just happened so fast. So like even prepared people like us who have go bags, presumably, and are, I don't know that you would have had, you know, that we would have necessarily have had time. I mean, it feels like everything just escalated so quickly. It's just terrifying to think about, and my heart just breaks.
One of those patients we came across on our way to the to the one we knew about. The way he described his story, he believes that his house was the very first to go, and he described. Being at his home, they knew there was a fire approaching, but not the extent of it, not the speed of it. And so he was out doing, I guess, what a lot of homeowners were doing, which was had his hose and he was trying to water down as much as he could for his home property.
Sure.
And standing there,
I'd probably do the same thing.
Yeah. But what he described was standing there, he could see through the trees, and there's kind of a forest in the back of his property. And he's spraying there. He can see the, and in the next moment, he described a fireball just coming out of the trees, blowing him off his feet. That's how he broke his ankle, getting all burned up. he was able to crawl and get into the house to get his family. And he said within minutes, their house was engulfed and they had seconds to get in their car and take off, to the point that, as they were fleeing through the flames there, you know, they saw a car with that a tree had fallen on. They could see people inside. And he had to say to his family, I can't walk. The fires, there's nothing I can do for those people. And they had to drive on. Just heartbreaking.
And there, yeah. And that's the whole thing, isn't it? Like sometimes you can't stop to rescue somebody else because
there was no time in this instance with 80 mile an hour winds, just pushing this fire faster than was. Yeah. There wasn't time. Doesn't mean that decision was any.
No, that's probably going to haunt him for the rest of his life. But I think that any reasonable person would tell him that he did what he had to do. Though as fast as that moved, I don't think you could. So what were, it sounds like a lot of the really critical patients were successfully medevaced early. So by the time you all got there, it was maybe a little bit more walking wounded. But as you and I know, you know, a diabetic without their medicines for a week is a disaster. And a lot of these diseases are just very quickly become disasters without their, normal medications. So what did you feel like were some of the most challenging situations, like medical or otherwise, that you encountered while treating and aiding people who were affected by this?
One of the things, I touched on a little bit of it, talking about this unit, which was unique. It was a unique dynamic to have to tailor my care to try and help someone, guide them, help them, understanding that you know, some of these other rules that were, you know, for example, this not being allowed to come back in, that was a wrinkle in how do I want to give this person the best care that I can, you know, and I'd be sitting there looking at someone like, look, you do realize 10 miles from here, people are surfing and restaurants are open. And it was so surreal, like, because you're in a blacked out neighborhood, it's pitch black. You know, this guy's got a pretty badly infected foot. He's on the wrong antibiotic, and I'm saying, okay, I'm going to put you on this on a better antibiotic, but you still need to go and get this seen, and encourage them with those just in that kind of a dynamic was challenging. You know, we came ready for anything. I mentioned some of the equipment that we brought, but you're right. It was ultimately walking wounded, but the stuff that you knew could become emergent pretty quickly. Yes, a diabetic without their insulin,
that could kill him.
A problem. Yeah,
or a septic patient because their foot gets worse and exactly. Suddenly they're septic and they die.
You're realizing that this is going to be going on for at least the next few days to a week. Before things are really kind of up to speed, they've got enough of this kind of emergent infrastructure in place. It's going to take a little bit of time again because of the scale of the disaster. Ultimately, what it was managing. The challenges were managing the medical care that was available without communication. Number one, and then number two. Was getting those supplies to the people that needed them when it came to actual, you know, prescription medications. We had pallets of insulin coming in, but had to be stored. Where was it going to be stored? Who was going to take ownership of the insulin? How are we going to disperse it and get it out right? And are there pharmacists around? And all that out in a communication dead zone was challenging. So then it's reaching out for Starlink satellites. And because the sat phone's not working right, and
I was wondering when Elon Musk was going to come in.
What about
this.
The person? Big time.
Where is he?
The Starlink system was amazing. Nice. Gosh, for everything, for our operations commands, for our medical tents, even for just the public, you saw them start popping up all over the place. That was awesome. That was huge.
I will say whatever people feel about anything he does, he shows up in disasters and he helps and he changes things, and it's greatly appreciated my end.
I myself, the first thing I did moving out here, realizing I was 100% in on a single cable company for my communications, that if that went down, I would have no means to communicate with the outside world. The first thing I did was got a Starlink system. Mm-hmm. But as far as finishing the question with challenges, it was then dealing with all the different chronic conditions, prioritizing which ones. You know, a patient would come up to you and here's my list of meds. And it's okay. You can don't worry about your statin. You'll be okay for a week or two. This blood thinner or this insulin or whatever, these ones, we don't want to stop those more for a day or two. That and helping them figure out how to get those and where, what we get. And that was a challenge. And that's where, we talked about this a little bit before. That's where I went in there as a volunteer with Aerial Recovery Group. I did not go in there as the CEO of Jace Medical. But it really was.
But there's crossover.
It was, as far as what drives me, in this company that I founded, which is the empowerment of individuals better prepared medically. If this wasn't just an absolute confirmation to what we're kind of at the point of the spear doing this kind of telemedicine in the United States, mm-hmm. and actually in the world we're moving. And so there's some challenges with that. And if this wasn't an information that we are doing something that is absolutely necessary and is life-saving, then nothing else would be. And it was heartbreaking at the same time, because that our system is built for people to have ahead of time. Jace Medical doesn't, I don't have an ability to send, pallets of medications and get them out to the people. Disaster. But if you can be prepared beforehand, that's what we're there for. And so it was just kind of heartbreaking to see these people and just be like, oh, if I could have just talked to you a week ago, you'd be all set. But at the same time, we're doing what we can and getting the word out. But that was a challenge. And it was one that I don't think, you think fire, you think, oh, we're gonna have all these burn patients. We're going to have to deal with, get them out to burn centers. And yes, that did happen. Yeah. But I would say relatively small numbers compared to the rest of the community, the hundreds and thousands of people who are affected by all of this and are now not able to get medical care for regular things that can quickly become life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I totally understand that. And what did you feel... Do you feel that anything in particular in your medical training or experience or any of your search and rescue training, did any of it or the recovery training modules? I know that those are incredible also. What did you feel prepared you the most for providing care in a disaster scenario like this, on this magnitude?
Yeah. I wish there was an easy answer that I could point to for people who are listening and say, it was this course I took and it was amazing. And this was what made all the difference.
Unfortunately, it'd be so nice.
Yeah. Right. Unfortunately I don't want to say it takes a lifetime and then discourage anyone from, but it takes a lot of different experiences in different ways throughout your life. I learned, like I alluded to before, we talked about before, learning about just different organizations, like we talked about dealing with the military, mm-hmm. dealing with fire departments, mm-hmm. that kind of experience when you come into a situation like this is invaluable and important. Having your confidence in your own abilities as a physician and what you know to do as a physician, which takes a long time. That is a lot of training and a long time to get to the point where you feel. You're not freaking out, like you can handle the stress of an acutely ill patient. That takes a long time. So there's no one thing. It's really just a lifetime of that you have to seek out. You have to put yourself out there, mm-hmm. Looking for these things and putting yourself in situations where maybe it's new to you and it's uncomfortable. And you've got the things you know that are comfortable that you could keep doing, but you got to get out there and do those things that push you. And what I've learned in my life, the more of those I do, the more doors are opened, and the mm-hmm. more, you know, it's about networking, the people that you meet, and mm-hmm. and all of this all plays together to make it so that when the call comes, you're ready to go.
You're ready to go. And I love my network, that when if there's ever anything that I feel not ready about or not sure about, I do feel like I can call, you know, Pav and say, oh my gosh, this is an awful eye thing. What do I do? Or Burge and call and say, what do I do? This is a terrible tooth problem. So yes, the network thing and that network of friends that you can call on, the phone a friend thing is huge. So I know we talked about a few of them, but were there any specific stories or encounters that really left a lasting impact on you during your time responding to the fire?
Yeah, I have to be careful.
I know. Without naming any names or compromising anyone privately.
Yeah, no, not for that. It's more for just not being a blubbering idiot on your
not podcast. Making both of us cry. That's okay. I'm ready.
So yeah, the one that just keeps coming to mind. I've been talking to my wife and a few others, just kind of in the letdown debrief time. You know, as you process all of this, the one that keeps mm-hmm. Resurfacing for me. Particularly because of the ties to Hawaii and mm-hmm. for those
your home.
Part of the world and kind of the aloha mentality of the culture here. So that first night, as we were making our way through these through the neighborhoods and we walked up to this, we were in a very, you know, Lahaina's got a lot, there's a lot of tourism, there's a lot of culture, and there's a lot of tourism there. There's a little neighborhood outside of Lahaina, hardcore local, we'll call it. These guys are generational Hawaiians, right? And we're making our way through these dark dirt roads, and we pass some people, you know, people are just out sitting, kind of visiting and processing, and we're trying to find this patient. And we walked by this group of young men and a couple of girls, and you know, they looked at us and they were smiling and so thankful to see us. And in my mind, I thought, just as we passed by these people, I thought, oh, these must be people who live here, who are taking in some of the people who have been displaced, you know. And so we went in, we took care of the patient, we came back out, started talking to them more. These were the people who had just lost their homes. These were the people who had just lost loved ones. And to see them still smiling and still grateful and just, I mean, that embodies the spirit. And that carried through, and you know, I talked about it with the community feel, where you had just this outpouring of love and support that crossed crossed political lines, crossed any kind of ideology, and was just beautiful. There were no, in many of these instances, there were no officials in sight, wherever they were and whatever they were dealing with, where we were in some of these areas. This was just people loving people. And there was no fighting. There was no hoarding. No, it was, and again, tying it into this Hawaiian culture, it was beautiful to see. And that's been my feel good take home from all this, mm-hmm. despite the tragedy, despair, the loss, you know, some of the horrible things that we did see. That's the part that I'm holding on to, and trying to push out there, rather than focus on, because there will be time and it will happen. This is the largest, the worst natural disaster in Hawaii's history. It's a fire disaster in the U.S. in over 100 years. And it's going to be analyzed and picked apart, and people are going to, you know, if there is a price to pay for people doing the wrong thing, that all that's going to come out and it'll all happen. But for me personally, I choose to focus on that mm-hmm. aspect of it, on the love.
That gives me hope. And what's going to be
necessary moving forward for the rebuild and all that. Yep. That's going to take a long time.
Yep, it will take a long time, but that gives me hope for the future and for our species in general. That's a really beautiful thing, because oftentimes, you know, I live most of my time in Florida, and you know, after hurricanes and stuff, there's always, you know, you're in danger of getting robbed. You know, stores are getting looted, and it's so profoundly disappointing, and it makes me so sad. And I think, like, oh my gosh, what does our future look like if we descend into anarchy this quickly? But I love that. Love that. And that gives me hope. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Well, continuing on, did you feel like you well equipped enough to impact maximum benefit? Like, was there any piece of gear or supply or equipment that you were like, oh, that was on the shelf, we should have grabbed that too. Or we should have grabbed more of that. Was there anything like that where you're like, because water purification, like just water.
Yeah, we had water purification, but really I think the ones that we really were like, oh, if we just had that, was a redundant satellite phone, because the one we had, which had been tested and proven immediately to the deployment, stopped working the second week.
Oh, God.
Certainly, we had one Starlink system. Had we known the extent of things, maybe bringing another two or three. I was going to bring large battery, you know, kind of battery generators. But those don't, the airlines don't like those so much. And so, even though I flew privately, I want to fly commercial or private. And so that got left behind. On the ground there, it was immediate power needs. That was a little tricky with generators. There wasn't a generator for hundreds of miles on the other island. A gas can for that generator was impossible. So, you know, you could use milk jugs or whatever, but so power was an issue. But the biggest would be communication. That was something that, and thankfully we had the power of social media. Not when I say we, not directly, this was through, gosh, just random influencers who lived in the area, who had a large following, who then appealed to their followers and were putting together shipments of medication, were putting together shipments of communications equipment, and then somehow got tied back to me. And I was able to let them know, okay, awesome, you've got a Starlink system. Or actually, the way it worked out was I said, hey, we don't need any more diapers. We're covered with diapers. What we do need is a Starlink system, at least one at this medical tent we're trying to set up. We'd already coordinated some others at another location, but we needed, and like within hours, that guy's got a Starlink system. He's going to be flying into the airport in a couple hours. Long story short, we got the communications hub through that setup where we needed. And those were just challenges we met along the way. And just, you know, it was a lot of networking. But again, all that networking was a combination of getting to areas where we could communicate via our own satellite or a cell phone reception, and then just beating the streets and actually going from point to point to make that contact where you had those black holes. But that was a big one. And I don't know, it's something that we'll still digest and probably plan better for next time. Again, maybe redundant phones. More than one satellite system. They are pretty bulky, those would be considerations for the time.
Yeah, it's like the whole saying with water purification, two is one and one is none.
Yeah, exactly. See, the military guys are going to hate that we did one is none. So Oh, shoot. I just
we're sorry. We're doing our best. No, you think, you know, you test today, you think you're good. Yeah, it's tough. It is tough. And especially when it's a big bulk of equipment, it's a little bit harder to justify.
That phone's pretty small. I'm going to say that phone's pretty small. Drop the ball on that one.
Okay. We'll accept it. We'll accept it and do better. We'll accept it and do better. And that's funny. That's my next question was communications and how this affects the ability to optimize the response. And I think we did a pretty good job of reviewing the comms challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't be.
It cannot. It is so important. And that's been in Colorado, and I'm sure you had the same problem in Utah. Like, we didn't have cell phones or cell phone service, and depending on where you are in the mountains, your radios don't work. And back then, when I was doing, I'm a little older than you, but back then if you didn't have a cell signal or radio, you know, eye to eye with your radio, like you had to just make field decisions and hope you were making the right decisions until you got closer. And it was definitely always a challenge.
And can work to some degree when you're dealing in kind of those with a patient or two. It's a kind of an isolated incident. Yes, you can make do. It's not ideal. It just really changes the game. We had from one end of the town to another was probably maybe like a 30-minute drive, but you had a couple of dozen medical professionals, medics, paramedics. We had some roving pharmacies, just a lot of resources, but everything was piecemeal and there was no coordination. It was really that scale of it is where that communication was vital to properly, you know, because you had people who couldn't get from one end to the other. They didn't have that luxury of transport that quickly. We're stuck in their area. And making sure you were allocating resources appropriately. And the only way to do that was, either face-to-face and then checking in the communication situated.
Yep, and that's why the chain of command is so important. So how do you think this response has, other than we touched on the incredible magnitude of it and just the utter heartbreaking losses, how has this differed from other disaster scenarios you've encountered in your career?
I haven't had, there's guys in the aerial recovery group who, went to Pakistan, went to Turkey, dealt with earthquakes and some of these other large scale disasters. My stuff has all been more that kind of backcountry, that kind of stuff. From a true natural disaster standpoint, this was new for me, and I think the nature of and it was commented on by everyone in the team who had been around earthquakes. This was unique in the ferocity, the high temperature. There was melted aluminum, melted glass. There was nothing in some of these. It was just a pile of ash. And that level of destruction, they've equated it to, like a nuclear blast. Like this was like Hiroshima, as far as the, how hot these temperatures got and how complete the destruction was. That was new. That was new for us and new for me and new for them. That's why early on, these reports of the death counts are taking a really long time to, everyone's wondering like, what's going on? Who's missing? Who's deceased? What's taking so long? And it's because at this point, just about any find that they have is through a cadaver dog, looking for either human remains in ash. I mean, it's like a crematorium, and you're trying to piece together who's what and what belongs to who. And That's this particular disaster.
Yeah, and on that note, I know we've touched a little bit on like debriefing, and I have a I think it's very, very important to debrief and talk about it and process it. What kind of emotional and like psychological toll does a disaster response like this have on colleagues, and how do you feel like the team is managing these challenges?
I think, you know, when you get a team of professionals together, especially who, you know, in their day job, they're, you know, whether they're firemen, mm-hmm. Paramedics, whatever their day job, you know, doing that kind of a professional activity, you take that same approach no matter what you're, what else you're doing. I know that's my case. That was the case for the guys I was with, mm-hmm. where when you're there, it's business, and you treat mm-hmm. it mentally, for the most part, like any other call out. You're paying attention.
Yeah, you do the job. You have to do the job.
To the safety aspects of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do the job. You do the job. You do your job. Afterwards, yeah, when you have more time to process things and realize kind of what it was that you just went through and were a part of. At Aero Recovery, they've instituted it's a required kind of a mental health debrief that we do with the team. And I think there's two really good aspects to that. They do it early on. It's supposed to be done within 72 hours mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. the completion of the call out. It needs to be done. There needs to be that kind of near term so that things are still kind of fresh and you can talk about things before they maybe get buried too much. But I think there's another benefit as an organization to hear because you don't you you know this was my first time meeting most of this team and we worked really well together and we gelled and we all got along and there was no but it's still it's at that kind of professional level. Being able to sit back and start talking about your feelings, because you got guys, you know, some of these, I don't know if it's a military only thing, but anyone, now I don't need to talk about my feelings. And this is just, you know, they're just not into it. I get it. But from an organizational standpoint, it's huge. It's immensely helpful and important to team mm-hmm. building, to get to know your mm-hmm. teammates, to trust, to understand how they process and what they're thinking about. And it just, you just gel on another level for that next call out. You're just that much better and more effective as a team. So even if you're not into it, I would say for those folks, at least I hope you're into having a cohesive team. And this is a really mm-hmm. important aspect of that.
That's an interesting point. And I think some of the more, like a lot of the military, I do some training for like military special forces, like in critical care and prolonged field care, and they are very modern when it comes to addressing stress, post-traumatic stress, and it's been inspiring, and it's just nice, and I felt kind of leveled our playing field, because when I was doing SAR in the 90s, my boss, it was mandatory. I mean, if you wanted to stay on this team, you debriefed, everybody did. And I feel like that set up expectations and habits for the rest of my career that are probably why I'm still practicing yep. and still happy today. And I'm very grateful for that. And I can't stress the importance of that, but I love that you can say, hey, but if you feel like you need to talk about your team and your feelings, at least help build the team. I really like that a lot too.
Yeah.
Now, another thing I love is like improvised field gear and stuff like that. Were there any sort of innovative or unique medical approaches or treatments that you had to sort of employ or pivot with due to the nature of the disaster, where you're like, well, we don't have this, but we have this and we can make that work? I'm sure that was the case for medications and substitutions, but.
Yeah, a little bit of that. There was certainly a little bit of the substitution stuff. I'm trying to think of like a real, you know, no, it was pretty cool. I mean, we had all the little gadgets that we brought, we used, whether that was, you know, someone who had some chest pain kind of issues, felt like their heart was racing and just to check for arrhythmias. And for the mm-hmm. most part,
what do you use for that? Do you guys have like Cardia?
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was, and it was actually from the paramedics pack. He brought his along, and,
that's great.
You know, and I had my, yeah, it worked. Yeah, it was, it worked great. We could see his, totally see it. Well, he wasn't in AFib, and, mm-hmm. he was actually in sinus rhythm. Things look good. And helped mm-hmm. him. Yeah, that was, so I'm just trying to think though of like, cause that would have been something like, oh shoot, if we had just had this, I can't really think of anything to be honest.
That's wonderful. That's a testament to the preparedness and of Aerial Recovery Group for sure. And I'm trying to make sure you all have everything you need. I love that. I always think of like the medics, the young medics, and I want to use these as opportunities to teach and help people think about what they might need to have in their kit. And so reflecting on this experience, what lessons you learned that could help better prepare medical professionals and disaster response teams responding to future disaster situations?
I think I touched on that before.
We did.
In my experience, yeah, speaking for me, it really is, it's getting as much as you can when you can, as far as when opportunities come up for training, being involved with groups, whatever that is, there's no shortcuts. You've got to take the time to learn the stuff and learn it well enough that you're comfortable doing it in any kind of a situation. But then there's a lot that comes along with that. And that's the stuff that you can take a FEMA, you can take different courses to learn about, command chain structure and incident, mm-hmm. Commands and all that stuff. And those are beneficial and great. It comes over time as you kind of just build that skill set. And with that I think is really important. You touched on it too, which is the networking aspect of all this, because that's going to play a big role in how you're put to work and where who trusts you to do what you say you can do. And so I would just say it's a process, but if it's something that you're passionate about and dedicated to, that as you go through that process, you'll start acquiring these skills, and then you'll start meeting the right people, and you'll find yourself doing whatever, you'll find yourself in the middle of unfortunately, that's not what you look for, but when the answer mm-hmm. comes and you're in the middle of one of the worst disasters in our history, you'll be ready to go. And it doesn't even have to be that big. Mm-hmm. It could be, there's any number of things. I can't tell you and I don't know, maybe I'm a bit of a dark cloud, but I've pulled people from rolled over vehicles 4 times in my life. But you're there, you're ready to answer the call, and you never know when it's mm-hmm. going to happen. But going through the process and taking the opportunities when they come up, prioritizing that, I'll to be frankly honest, did search and rescue as an undergraduate, working, being on call 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year, 24 hours a day, was not beneficial for my undergraduate education academically. I'd be out on a rescue call, pulling down a body we just recovered from an avalanche at 2 or 3 in the morning. And I'd get home at 4 and I'd have to wake up 2 hours later to go take a final. And I didn't do very well on the final, I can promise you right now. So there was, I made some sacrifices there that maybe closed mm-hmm. some doors for me academically. You know, maybe I could have gone to Harvard or something for medical school. But at the end of the day, it's my
if they passion only knew
for what I was doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved the experience I gained and my path, and it all comes down to just the determination. Don't take no for an answer. If it's something that you love, that you are passionate about, it'll work out and you'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great advice. That is great advice. Now, what are there any critical lessons or advice in disaster? And I know we touched on this earlier too, but I want to summarize it for people. In disaster prevention and preparation that you would give to lay people. You know, I've given lectures on, oh, these are the things you should have in a go bag. You know, you should have at least two ways to purify water. You should have this, you should have that. If you can't grab your go bag, that's tough. Whether it's in your car or wherever it is, if it's not accessible to you, you know, if your go time is faster than you have, you know, then it becomes more difficult. But any advice for lay people in how they can buffer themselves against tragedies?
Yes. And I guess you could get into some of the, like you mentioned, you know, you get into the specifics of here's how you put together your go bag and here's the, here's the kinds of meds you want in there. And I think to kind of make it a little more general, just initially here, I would say, you know, obviously you want to look at your area. What are the things that you need to be prepared for where it is that you spend most of your time? You know, I'm here on the North Shore of Oahu. I'm not too worried about fires and tsunamis and floods. And so planning my preparedness around that and having multiple, you know, having a plan A, plan B, plan C. You mentioned, yeah, if you can't get to your go bag in your closet, you better have something else staged in another place. Those are kind of practical things. I think though, just speaking really high level, and that would be like I mentioned to these people in Napili and who were, you know, north of Lahaina and the Lahaina neighborhood, is just actually being concerned about your preparedness level at all. Is there are some, you don't have to go, it's easy to go down the rat hole and it's easy to get overwhelmed and say, oh my gosh, like this, number one, the expense of getting all this stuff and stuff I'm never going to use. And if you're not passionate about, you know, I'm probably not speaking to the right people that are listening to this because they're all passionate about it. But if you're not passionate about that stuff, that's okay. A couple of really easy things, right? There's a couple of really easy things that you can do. If we're talking to the passionate people, then let's say, hey, here's how you talk to the people who aren't so passionate, your neighbors, your friends, your family members, to let them know that they don't have to be, to at least have some level of preparedness, and it can be pretty basic. And it's not that hard to do, you know, a little bit of water storage, a little bit of food storage, can go a long ways in these kinds of instances. And having, if you're on chronic medications, then you need a supply. Because I can tell you right now, and I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole, but we're on a knife's, it's razor's edge when it comes to our pharmaceutical supply chain here in the United States. Everybody should have a backup. Mm-hmm. Apps of not just chronic medications, but their antibiotics and other emergency types of medications. And everyone can do that. So that's my long-winded answer there. As far as for a layperson, some things to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. And so I always feel like to some degree as a society, we are incredible, you know, but it's because people are incredible. It's because the volunteers mobilize quickly. And, you know, did the volunteer helpers beat the federal helpers there, or did everybody show up at the same time? Because I'm sort of like, you know, as a society, are we prepared to respond to this tragedy, like one of the worst disasters I've ever seen? And are we prepared to respond to the next one? To my mind, if we don't have all these volunteers who like we're going, it's not quick before people can get the help that they need. Is that an accurate assessment?
Right, I think. 100%. Of course, we should never wholly depend on the government, on really anyone else other than ourselves and our immediate circle, our tribe. Yes, it took FEMA. Was it Friday that they first showed up with their kind of really core small team? It wasn't really until Saturday that they were really doing anything at scale and really started ramping up. Mm-hmm. So you think, okay, in the grand scheme of things, Wednesday morning to Saturday, that's not too bad.
Pretty quick.
In that mm-hmm. period that is pretty dire for the people who are living through it. And yes, their machine's huge and big, and they're going to be there for the long term, and it's great. But no, you're right. Community is absolutely vital in those first 12, 24, 48 plus hours, 72 hours. There is nobody else. There's nobody else that's going to, the army can't mobilize everything and fly in 24 hours to fix your problem. And your needs are immediate. So, how do we prepare better in the future? I do think there needs to be more of this talked about on a community level. Certainly here in Hawaii, I can say that's the case. Other places in the country, I've been in other places where I've seen some pretty good kind of community action when it comes to emergency preparedness and planning and getting the word out and having engagement from the community, and other places where it's virtually non-existent. So yes, that is something that I think we could do a lot better in. You don't have to be in a real disaster prone. It should be out there on every on some level in every community, and how best to put that, it would make a world of difference.
Oh, it would, because neighbors helping neighbors happens the fastest. So a lot of people and people listening to this, they want to help. They want to help the people of Lahaina. So for those people who do want to help in some way, where would you direct them? Like, how do you think their efforts from afar would best help? Like, as far as what donations are getting to the people on the ground at 100%, you know, how can they best help?
Yeah, so my worry is, I guess in the longer term, you know, it was an amazing response. All the world's eyes were on Maui, and supplies were flooding in. It was incredible. And those immediate needs were met for the most part. But what happens, you know, 2 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, 3 months from now, as this rebuilding process goes, you were talking about some 4,500 people who are at this point. Like in the longer term, how do we maintain that level of support? My worry, you know, as far as immediate things that people can do, of course, there's the larger organizations, the Red Cross is there in full force. And certainly if that's something that people are comfortable with, that would be somewhere to go. For me personally, I feel like I like to know that my donation is going to the place that I'm giving it to. And there's the only one, not the only one, I'm sure there's many, but the one that we at Jace Medical and myself are supporting, it's called the Hawaii Coalition Foundation, I believe. They have identified, basically, it's if you donate there, everything you donate will go to Maui, and it will go to this fire disaster. And they've got a couple partners that they work with to help disperse those things to where they need to go. So I would point people to the Hawaii Community Foundation. Got a way to vet or know who you're giving to on a, you know, media has got, gets a bad rap, but I think we can use it for good. And certainly was used for good to help us get a lot of supplies into Lahaina during this crisis. And there's a lot of people putting stuff out there with a means to get. Maybe you just buy a gift card and you actually give it, it's given to an individual who needs it. Those kinds of things is another level of how you can help. A little more vetting needs to go into that, but for something that kind of been vetted and is out there, the Hawaii Community Foundation, I think, is a great place to start.
Awesome. Hawaii Community Foundation. Is there a website or anything, or can they Google it and they'll be able to find it?
Yeah, it's Hawaii Community Foundation is their website. And then I would just mention for any of, you know, we are giving through, we are donating a portion of anyone that comes to Jace Medical, J-A-S-E medical.com. We're donating a portion of those sales to the Hawaii Community Foundation, and at the same time, get yourself prepared with antibiotics and or chronic meds.
Thank you so much for spending time with me this evening. Really appreciate it. Do you have any other parting words of wisdom for our listeners?
Any more parting words of wisdom? Yeah, not really. I think I just to reiterate the
it's always the hardest question for last.
The beautiful aspect. Yeah. The beautiful aspect that we can, as humans, on a human to human level, it's seeing that it's unfortunate to bring us together that way. But certainly it is beautiful, and it's something that does give me hope for humanity. And hopefully we'll get to where we can do that without these tragedies. But it has been heartening to see that love, to see that community. And I was blessed and fortunate to be a part of this whole ordeal.
And I can't thank you and the people of Lahaina enough for giving all of us hope for the future and hope in humanity. And I've always heard, you know, in times of trouble, look for the helpers. If you look for the helpers, you'll find the hope. And so I just want to say thank you so much to Dr. Sean Rowland for being my guest today. I know that this is an incredibly personal disaster, and that these are difficult conversations. And I truly appreciate your willingness to speak with World Extreme Medicine about your intimate knowledge of this tragic fire on Maui. The people of Hawaii, and in particular this region, will remain in our thoughts and in our targeted efforts to continue to assist them as they recover from this. And so thank you again to everyone listening. I'm Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and it is my pleasure to share these extreme medicine adventures with you. And if you're listening with us, you too are an extreme medic, and we welcome you to the World Extreme Medicine family. So please stay safe out there and always keep pushing your boundaries.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.